I just called this series, and you're by no means obligated to attend all the series, but the idea of Christ and Oriental religions. And I chose that deliberately because if I said other religions, I would have to cover a lot more than I intend to. Namely, you would have to go to what we sometimes call Mohammedanism, or more properly, Islam, and Judaism as well. So I want to keep it to Asia, to India, China, Japan, Southeast Asia. And then I said Christ rather than, let's say, Christianity, to suggest that the main conflict, let's say, of our faith and the other faith is the uniqueness of the historical event of Jesus Christ as over against the thought and system of these other religions. This will come out more clearly as we go along, I hope. Now, in the bookstore, I've ordered, it was hard to try to figure out what to order for this, but I ordered one main thing, and that's, it doesn't appear like this now. It's in the Harper Torch book, it's a little bigger pages and so on. It's called The Faith of Other Men by Wilfred Cantwell Smith. And I think they've got many copies over there, so if you're interested, you can pick them up. I think they're $1.95. There are a few copies of another book by Smith, which those of you who really are interested in getting more into what religion and other religions are would be very valuable, namely The Meaning and End of Religion. It looks like this, and this is the way it appears. Also by Wilfred Cantwell Smith, A New Approach to the Religious Traditions of Mankind. In this one, he takes up five different faiths. They are Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, the Chinese. Then he does have a chapter on the Christians and Jews. Also, at the end of the book, he has another chapter on the Christian in a religiously plural world, which I think is a fine statement on his part. He gave it to the Canadian Theological Society in 1961. Well, this other book is, I'd say, more scholarly. Half the book, it looks fairly thick, it's 352 pages, but half the book is notes. So it's about 150 pages of text. Religion in the West, and by religion he puts that in print in quotes to indicate that, what do you mean by that term, religion? And then meaning how the West interprets the term religion. Then he has another chapter on other cultures and, quote, the religions. Four, since Smith's specific field of expertise is Islam, he has a chapter on Islam. Five, is the concept adequate? And six, the cumulative tradition. Seven, faith. What is his concept? His idea is that maybe we should get rid of the word religion, at least for purposes of discussing these other faiths, and he prefers to substitute for it two terms. One, faith, and the other, cumulative tradition. He says, when you're talking about other people's religions, to them it is not a religion. You don't believe in a religion. You are a follower of Christ. Well, so the Buddhists are the followers of Buddha, the servants of Allah for the Muslims, and so on and so on. They don't regard themselves as adherents of a religion. In fact, some of these, quote, religions, unquote, do not even call themselves religion and have no term for it. Hinduism, for example, there's no word for religion in Sanskrit. So what he suggests is that we think of religion as being first and foremost for any adherent faith. This is what you're really talking about. And faith expresses itself in creeds, yes. It expresses itself in art. Cultures of countries express the religion, and so on. But beyond that, we talk of the cumulative tradition, and cumulative tradition means the whole history of the people who have held this faith down through history and the traditions it has accumulated during that time. Christianity has a lot of traditions that have accumulated over 2,000 years, many of which we may not even pay any attention to anymore, but which are there in the deposit, you might say, of the cumulative tradition. And so he argues that to him would be a preferable way of understanding it, and that's why it raises the question, is the concept adequate? Does it really enable us to try to understand another faith. This book is an excellent book, I think, for philosophers of religion. And in fact, many philosophy of religion classes in universities use this book because it is so excellent on this. As he puts it on faith, men's faith finds expression in many forms. It can be expressed more historically. Faith has been expressed in words, both prose and poetry. It has been expressed in patterns of deeds, both ritual and morality. It has been expressed in art, in institutions, in law, in community, in character, and in still many other ways. But fundamentally, the faith is the inward conviction of the heart of a person. Well, that's enough about books. There are some other books that I had mentioned to Carol, which she did order, but then put them in the library here, in the Osgard Library. One of them is a book that I'll refer to now. We talked about Confucius today, by Fingarette, F-I-N-G-A-R-E-T-T-E. Let me think. There is another one called, it's by a man named John Donne, The Way of All the Earth, and I think he put that in the library. And there may be a couple others that I can't think of, but it'll occur to me another day. I've also put in the library, on this first table, just some articles that were lifted from the Listener magazine on comparative religion a few years back. There's one on Hinduism, one on Buddhism, one on Islam, and then one by an author called The Unknown Hinduism of Christianity, trying to show the interrelationships of Hindu thought with Christian thought. He calls it The Unknown Hinduism of Christianity. Well, it was a reference to a book written by someone called The Unknown Christ of Hinduism. Now, before I take up Confucius, just a few more comments as to why should we be interested as Christians, as Westerners, in these other religions. First of all, let me just say, as Americans, we ought to be interested in other cultures, and therefore we ought to be interested in the religions of those cultures as well, because religion probably has more of an impact on a culture than any other single cultural factor you could name. When you talk about the ways of thinking of other peoples, what has influenced it? It's their ways of thinking are influenced by their values. But what influences their values? Basically, their religious convictions. And even the deposit, even this cumulative tradition that Smith talks about, will affect these values, so that people will imbibe values that are in their culture without even knowing sometimes the religious roots from which they spring. Last week I mentioned to group them, but I'm assuming that this is a different group, some of these comments, but let me repeat them for those those who've heard them will have them repeated. Winston Churchill, in an address at Harvard right after the World War II, remarked that the United States, almost against its will, had emerged from its self-imposed isolation and had now become a world power, which Britain had once been. And then he said this, "Remember," he warned, and he pointed to the future, "that the price of greatness is responsibility." And he might have added, "Responsibility includes a well-informed and world-aware citizenry." Now, Churchill was prophetic, because ever since that time, the United States has assumed an unprecedented role in world affairs. Never in its history has our country been more involved in abroad than it is now. Do you realize that every year, for example, close to 1.5 million Americans, maybe most of the military personnel and dependents, are living and working outside the United States? That another 5 million are involved each year with citizens of other lands and cultures, whether in travel, business, professional duties, immigration? And yet, despite our growing involvement all over the world, there is mounting evidence that the United States has neglected to build any broad competence in international education. The international dimension of U.S. higher education, for instance, speaking of the colleges, is far from adequate.
At the time of the Vietnam outbreak, there were only 8 scholars in the United States carrying on any scholarly research about Vietnam. Only 8. And not one of them could qualify as a senior academic specialist on that divided country. Now, I'm sure things have improved since then, but still, we're way, way behind. So just a few years ago, only about 24 of our 1,500 four-year colleges and universities required candidates for the bachelor's degree to take a single course dealing with non-Western areas. Required. That didn't mean that many of them didn't have courses, but in the colleges and universities where there were such courses available, only 10% of the students enrolled took advantage of that opportunity. It's like pulling teeth to get people to get interested in something outside of America and Europe. Fewer than 5% of American teachers in elementary and secondary schools have taken courses dealing with world society, international issues, or non-Western subjects. And despite the near certainty that the problems of living with China will dominate the next generation, only a few years ago, I think it's improved since then, but only a few years ago, only 5% of our four-year institutions of higher education offered courses in the Chinese language. It's probably up to about 10% now. And yet, I still get applications from teachers of Chinese, many of them Chinese nationals, that is, from Taiwan, who are looking for jobs, which means that they haven't expanded that far, that there's a, you know, there's a shortage. There are more Chinese teachers than there are positions right at the moment. So, that's, I would just say that in terms of our worldwide responsibility, we are tragically ignorant of other cultures and peoples. And yet each year we receive in the United States about 110,000 foreign students who come to our campuses, another 11,000 foreign professors. We've had about 5,000 U.S. scholars abroad and 21,000 American students each year. But most of our people going abroad go to Europe, almost 60%. The surprising thing is how slow we've been in trying to internationalize our curriculum. There are only 3 states that require any kind of international studies in the public schools. One of these is North Carolina, another is Hawaii, and I don't remember what the 3rd one was. Well, what I'm trying to say is that we ought to have our education, just as Americans, ought to be more widely expanded so that we can all, you might say, get an education with a global view. And it isn't only that we understand something about the world, we understand something about ourselves by understanding about the world. And it's just part of our own growing up and to realize the world we live in. Now, most of us would think of ourselves as culturally deprived if we didn't have the music of Europe, Beethoven or Mozart, Verdi or whatever. But isn't it just as likely that we are culturally deprived if we don't know the thought of India or China? We must get rid of our provincialism. As Buckminster Fuller, the creator of the geodesic domes that house our radar installations all over the world, he calls our Earth Spaceship Earth. Namely, we are all in it together on a little spaceship hurtling through space. And one nation alone today can't fight the kind of problems that are confronting us worldwide. For instance, take pollution as one of the things that we've become aware of in our time. One nation alone can't fight that. Let's say that out of the Ganges, DDT flows out to the Indian Ocean and shows up in Alaska salmon. But without the DDT, malaria increases in India. So now what are you going to do to have worldwide control? India can't decide for itself. It has to try to conquer its problem, yet it's affecting the whole world, what it does. Or the efforts of population control in one part of the world will not solve it for the whole world. Is it not a worldwide concern? I think it was only recently, at least within the last couple of years, that a worldwide conference on the oceans was held because it was realized that the kind of pollution of the oceans offshore from your own country affects oceans thousands of miles away. It doesn't just affect you right around you. You aren't that isolated. It affects everyone else. And Americans are more and more involved the world over in our diplomacy, our business dealings. Certainly we don't want to remain ignorant of other cultures, especially if we want to persuade them of our good intentions. And we sometimes offend other cultures because we do not really know them. And one does not really put his own culture in jeopardy when he studies another culture. Much more likely is cross-cultural understanding on a new plane. Well, so much for the, let's say, that looking at it from the American side. Now, from the religious side, why should we, as Christians, want to look at other religions? Let me just cite a couple of instances of on this. A British theologian named Perrender says that the impact of Eastern thought on Christian thought is likely to be the Third Reformation. He calls it the Third Reformation. The First Reformation you all know, namely the Reformation of Luther and the effect on the problem of justification before God that had. But, as Perrender puts it, it did not come to grips with the critical problems of the Bible. All right, the Second Reformation, then, he argues, is the one brought about by the scientific revolution and enlightenment of the 19th century. Such books as Robinson's Honest to God are cited by Perrender as evidence of the tail end of that revolution. One of the things that Honest to God argues, for example, is that the idea of God as up there is pre-Copernican. How can you talk about God up there? He's just as much down there in a Copernican universe. And in the resulting confusion, however, of how you're going to picture this, Perrender says, maybe new light will come to us from the East. Thus the Third Reformation. Now, in the first centuries of the church, the church was surrounded by other religions. And the church took Greek forms and found its success chiefly in the Greco-Roman world. As a result, it did not encounter at that time the Indian religions, which were already several hundred years old, even at that time. But it is only today that they are meeting with increasing intensity. Translations of Eastern religious classics, hitherto unavailable, are now easy to get hold of. It really all occurred probably at the early part of the century with the work of the Cambridge philologist Max Müller, translating the sacred books of the East, as he called them, about 50 volumes. For the first time, the great classics of religion of the East became available. And Christians woke up to the fact that they did not have the only sacred literature in the world that was worth reading. But our official theology in the church still ignores the ideas from the East. Even in Robinson's Honest to God, there's only one little reference to the effect of Far Eastern religion on Christian thought. So here we have mostly closed our eyes. And one reason, no doubt, is the difficulty of understanding the great wealth of material that's at one's disposal from the East. With 50 volumes, the sacred books of the East, how are you going to even begin? But another factor is that there is no training. Very few seminaries deal with it. If you go to our seminary at St. Paul, you won't get anything on it. Now, another factor that's brought up by Cantwell Smith is that he was talking about Paul Tillich, and he cited the instance of a student who came to him about some question about Paul Tillich, and he says it looked to him as though with the theology of Paul Tillich you were coming to the end of a time when one can ignore the world scope of religions. Because here is a theologian that has mainly argued, as he puts it, from within the Western tradition. And let me quote from him. I suggest that we are about to enter a comparable situation. He had spoken about the impact of science on the church and so on, with the other religious traditions of mankind. The time will soon be with us when a theologian who attempts to work out his position unaware that he does so as a member of a world society in which other theologians equally intelligent, equally devout, equally moral are Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, and unaware that his readers are likely to be Buddhists or have Muslim husbands or Hindu colleagues, such a theologian is as out of date as is one who attempts to construct an intellectual position unaware that Aristotle has thought about the world, or that existentialists have raised new orientations, or unaware that the Earth is a minor planet in a galaxy that is vast only by terrestrial standards. Philosophy and science have impinged so far on theological thought, so far, more effectively than has comparative religion, but this will not last. And thus, as he says, we are at the end. The new generation of the church, unless it is content with a ghetto, will live in a cosmopolitan environment which will make the work of even a Tillich appear parochial. Last winter, Jaroslav Pelikan, a Lutheran theologian, said that if he were a young theologian about to begin work today, that's what he would make his major focus of study, the Asian religions. Let me just mention one other, John Donne, whose book we have here in the Oscar Library now then, Way of All the Earth, speaks of a phenomenon that is becoming more common in our day, which he calls passing over. We pass over from one culture to another. For instance, we go touring in Europe, and then we have an equal and opposite process, which can be called coming back. But when you come back with new insight into your own culture. Similarly, if we read a biography of a great man, we pass over to his life, and then we come back with new insight into our own. Now, this can occur in religion, too. One passes over to the standpoint of another religion and then comes back to one's own with new insight. The aim is not to become a member of another religion, just as it was not the aim of your going to Europe to become a member of the French Republic. The point is to go over to sympathetically try to understand the other culture, the other religion, and then to come back with new light on one's own culture or one's own religion. And Donne puts it this way, passing over and coming back, it seems, is the spiritual adventure of our time. So whether you prefer to speak of it as having a few glimpses into the Third Reformation, or whether you prefer to think of it as passing over and coming back with John Donne, nevertheless, I think it's very valid and very important for us as Christians to try to understand the faith of other men, particularly these Oriental faiths, which are held by perhaps more millions than any other faith in the world. And can we learn from them something for our own sake? One of the points that Donne makes in his book is that we may come back to appreciate some forgotten items of our own tradition, some things that we have tended to neglect, because we have, in the onrush of history, been so concerned with other problems. Today, one of the interesting things is that students in many American college universities are becoming more and more interested in a kind of romance with Asia. I had a Christian Century article, which I guess I left in my room, which I'll bring another day, because it really refers to Hinduism in particular. But in there, the article talks about neo-mysticism and the counterculture movements and the tendency in the romance of young people today with the East, because they feel the West has got nothing to offer but a lot of technology, a lot of kind of manipulation of that kind of manipulation, and has no appreciation of the inner life and of the inner soul. Now, this may not be true literally, namely in the Christian tradition there are those resources, but we have tended to neglect them and don't even know they exist. Luther, for example, was a great lover of mysticism, but very few of us would know it because we don't dwell on that aspect of Luther's thinking. Well, that's enough, I guess, to give you some idea. Oh, here it is. Going East, Neo-Mysticism and Christian Faith. Just the quotation here. He says, whether out of some book by a currently popular social diagnostician, Theodore Roszak, for instance, or Charles Wright, or as a result of a pop party bust, a hassle at a peace demonstration, involvement in an ecological crusade, the middle-class young of the upcoming generation are developing a common picture in the head. They see a society addicted to picture tubes, high-rises, and supersonic jets, A society where all modern techniques from lasers to miniature circuitry conspire to revolutionize work and play. Back of the products lie certain premises, that the methods of the laboratory and the factory, empirical, rational, pragmatic, define the limits of reality, prescribe the right way to deal with it, and promise humanity a horn of plenty. Moreover, as the young see it, somewhere up there at the controls of the awesome new instruments are cadres of experts with plans and plots of their own. But their high scheming often appears to be done in such compartmentalized fashion that it looks like nobody is in charge. And what have these technocratic gods wrought? Pollution, hate, war, plague, famine, and death. The promises of technocracy have not been kept. So the young insist, if the science technology of the West has brought us to a dead end, it's time to look for another way. Go east, young human. If you take that way, you will not tinker with the outer world, but you will discover and relate to the inner cosmos. You will not seek to subdue and control everything, but groove with the all. You will not ratiocinate and dissect, but experience and feel. Neither talk, 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 nor act, but meditate and contemplate. You will not revel in things man-made and urban, but learn to love things natural and close to the soil. Be attracted not to the complexity, hardness, and precision of the technician, but to the simplicity, softness, and gentleness of the guru. Not live by the creed that it's every man for himself and the devil take the hindmost, but believe in human goodness, risk the act of sharing, and affirm things communal. And finally, you will refuse to abide by the rigid manners and morals of Middle America and adopt a freed-up lifestyle from hair and clothing to music and mating. The birth of what Jacob Needleman, in his recent book on neo-mysticism, calls these new religions a feeling, fantasy, mystery, and commonality is a natural outcome of the new quest of youth. Then he goes on to talk about the Eastern religions. Yeah?
I'd like to know, were you dealing with that for Luther's mysticism?
Well, Luther was...
You said he...
Yeah, he was he was very fond of the German Mysticism, or I always get that mixed up, German theology or something like this. This was his favorite reading outside of the Bible. And
was that mysticism?
Yeah, and it was a mystical work. And of course in the 16th century, some of the mystical writers in the Lutheran church, Meister Eckhart, Jacob Tauler, Jacob Tauler, Jakob Arndt, and others developed very strongly a mystical bent. Lutheranism has always been accused by Calvinism of being more mystical. You know, Calvinism always has God up there, man here, and never the twain should really get confused with each other. Whereas they always felt that Lutherans are so mystical, they have God coming right down here in the bread and wine, and so on and so on. You know, this... So we've always been thought of as the more mystical side of the Protestant Reformation. Similarly with the fact that we are more Augustinian in our whole theology compared to Calvinism, I think, on that score. We could go into that in other ways, but I better get...
I never thought of it in that way.
Yeah. Well, for instance, sometimes it's gone overboard in Lutheranism. Pietism is a very strong... mystical kind of view, the inner life and the whole concern with the inner life in such a way that it had no concern with the outer life whatsoever. And Lutheranism had in some cases tended just to be completely divorced from anything about the world, with the idea that religion is only concerned with your inwardness anyway. And therefore Christianity, we still have some of that. You know, preachers should never say anything about society, about politics, or anything like that. They should only talk about God and the soul, and dwell on that. That's a very mystical approach, and the idea that religion is mere inwardness. We've had that background more than other Protestant traditions. Well, one of the reasons I want to take up the Chinese first was that it occurred to me as I was dealing with these religions that the Hindus talk about three ways of salvation that I think are a good pattern for all the Asian religions, may even be a pattern for any. Namely, they speak of three ways that men can be saved.
The way of karma, the way of faith, and the way of knowledge. And the way of karma is the way of works. The way of faith is God's grace. And the way of knowledge is supposed to be higher. It's the kind of the way of mysticism. Now, when they talk about the way of karma, this is really what I would say we would call morals. Namely, that the moral life is a way to salvation. And it's by doing your duties in the station that you are placed and fulfilling these duties to the utmost that one will be saved. Now, transposing that now to China, it seems to me that Chinese religion, outside of Taoism and Buddhism, and especially then in Confucianism, which is in so many ways the dominant attitude of the Chinese, that Confucianism is really a way of karma. It's a way of works, of deeds, and it's a way of, by doing one's duties, that one could achieve the goal. And that's why I want to take that one first, and then you really have covered what the Hindus and even Buddhists might say on that kind of approach. The main Hindu ways is not the way of karma, but the way of faith and the way of mysticism. Similarly, in Buddhism, the main ways would be the way of knowledge and the way of faith. Yet all three often get in the picture. For instance, if you've heard of yoga, the eight steps of yoga, the very first two steps are the moral steps. Namely, don't do this, don't do that. Abstain from this, abstain from stealing, abstain from drink, abstain from this. Then you can begin on the bodily postures that will train the mind to concentrate. Then, after you've done that, after the body's been calm, then you can meditate on spiritual truth. But it begins with the moral. And many Hindus would argue that that's where everybody must begin. You must begin with the moral. Then you can go up to the higher stage of religion. In some ways, you could also talk that way in Christianity. Paul Homer, I don't know if he's going to get here, but I'll borrow a favorite phrase of his that he talks about, namely that unless a person really does take morality seriously, it's pretty hard for people to really take religion seriously. That is, if it doesn't matter whether there's right and wrong, and if it matters of relativity, the religion is likely to be just sort of some kind of embroidery on life. Religion has to be moral, too. It doesn't mean that that's the essence of religion, but it does mean that that's involved in it. For instance, what sense does justification by faith mean unless a person really takes morality seriously? Because if you take morality seriously, then you come to realize that never by morality can you possibly save yourself. But one of the steps toward being conscious that you can't save yourself is to take morality seriously. Because if you don't, you never come to that realization. That is, a person who is completely oblivious of moral laws, moral rules, trying to live humanly, trying to you might say, justify his life before his fellows if he doesn't have a God. He doesn't at least try to do that. He's not going to become conscious of the fact that he always fails and therefore needs really God. Justification by faith means that one realizes finally that works cannot save a man, that he cannot attain his relation to God by that means. And this is something which I think the religion of works, if you want to put it that way, is something that I think you see in Confucius. But it's a valid step on the way to religion. It's a valid step. And without it, religion, as I say, would just become an ornament on life. Well, picture in your mind's eye China and the history of China in five main periods. First is the prehistory to the 6th century B.C. All right. The next period is the classical period of Chinese history, namely from Confucius, 6th century. He was born in 551 B.C. He died in 479. To the advent of Buddhism in the 1st century A.D. 6th century now to A.D. 1st century. Third stage, the post-Buddhist period, from the 1st century A.D. to the Neo-Confucian revival in the 10th century. Some call this period the Golden Age of China, because it's during this period that the great art, you've seen these great paintings, you know, with the huge landscapes that are on scrolls and so on. Many of them come from this period. But many of the greatest pottery, and Ming China and so on, come from this time. Well, Ming China is a little later. But some of the greatest works of art are from this time. So sometimes it's called the Golden Period. It's really a conflation of Taoist and Buddhist viewpoints. And you might say that this art went over to Japan and became really the norm of Japanese art in the 11th century AD. But the fourth period is the late, is called sometimes just the late period. It's from the Song Dynasty, 960 AD, to the modern age, about the 19th century. And then the last period is the impact of the West on China, the 19th and 20th centuries. If you visit the National Palace Museum in Taipei, you will notice in the very first room you encounter some oracle bones, mainly of tortoise shell, although also from ox bone, which were heated in the fire, and cracks then appeared on the shell. And these cracks were then interpreted to obtain a negative or positive answer to a question that was put. And the answer was then inscribed in the bone. Often was about hunting, fishing, or illness, and so on. Thus it was felt that this was kind of the background of Chinese religions, maybe a kind of polytheistic religion, although one god began to appear somewhere out of the mists of the primitive, called Shangdi, really. Now, to the average Westerner, Confucianism appears as a religion, but it is no more a religion than Platonism or Aristotelianism is a religion in the West. In the four books, sometimes called the Bible of the Chinese people, there is no story of creation. There's no mention of heaven or hell. Now, of course, it depends on how you define religion as over against philosophy. But as one of the great Chinese interpreters of Confucius and of Chinese thought, Feng Yulan, writes, he says that for his part, philosophy is systematic, reflective thinking on life. Few people reflect, and fewer yet reflect systematically. Now, that's not too bad a way of looking at it. I often say to students that argument is what distinguishes philosophy from religion. Namely, philosophy tries to give arguments for its viewpoint, not just assert it. Now, when you read Confucius, you won't find anything particularly religious about him. And he is mainly a moralist, someone who seems to be giving, and I'll pass this around now, a lot of different sayings. And you could just skim through it yourself. Just look for just one of these paragraphs, and almost all of them will be some kind of moral advice. When a friend died homeless, Confucius would say, "Entrust the funeral to me." Presents from friends, even vehicles and horses, he did not acknowledge with a deep bow. So on. So I'll just pass that around. You can take a look at the. In discussions of Confucianism as a religion, what interpreters seek to do is to give us the ethical views of Confucius, and then try to say that he also spoke about heaven once in a while. Now, we know that the ancient Chinese spoke a great deal about ancestor worship, and there was also worship of divine spirits. But as time went on, two deities emerged. One was Shangdi, who was worshipped by the Shang dynasty. And then when the Zhou conquerors came, about 10th century B.C., this is the name of a dynasty, C-H-O-U, pronounced Zhou, they revered a deity known as Tian, or heaven. And the two deities became conflated into one deity during that dynasty. And also the Zhou dynasty introduced another idea to explain their right to the empire. They called it the Mandate of Heaven, because heaven would favor the good and turn away the evil. Now, about the only way that one can relate Confucius to all this is that he spoke of his way, which he urged men to follow, as being the way of heaven. In other words, he was adopting what the Zhou dynasty talked about as sanctioning their dynasty as the way that would sanction his views. But he did not really show much, let's say, reverence to any deity.
He did not believe that heaven rewards the virtuous and punishes evil, nor did he believe in any kind of fatalism. He condemned human sacrifices, which was a dying custom at his time anyway, and he was opposed to people turning to religious practices as a substitute for his moral way that he was preaching. So often the term is applied to Confucianism, humanism. It's a humanistic viewpoint. Yet Confucius in later centuries became the object of a state cult. And emperors performed sacrifices at his tomb. Now many feel that what happened here was that with the coming in of Buddhism in the first century AD, with a lot of what we recognize as religious practices, ritual practices, and so on, there was some desperate attempt on the part of those who felt this was a foreign intrusion on Chinese soil to get something Chinese. And what would it be? Well, Confucius, the great teacher, the one who had been made the official teacher of China in the Han Dynasty in the first century BC. So in the 7th century AD, it was ordered by the emperor that every prefecture in China should erect a temple to honor Confucius. And 2 centuries later, statues of Confucius would be erected. In the 16th century, by imperial edict, the cult was much simplified, and the images of Confucius were replaced by traditional tablets honoring ancestral spirits. So was Confucius ever regarded as a god? Was it ever really a state religion? Well, it was very dubious. For instance, Confucius never became the focus of devotional life in the way in which the Buddha would be for Buddhism. And much of the ceremonial attached to Confucianism was highly formal. Since everyone honored his ancestors, so one would honor Confucius, much like you would honor George Washington as the founder of the state. There was no special form of worship for Confucius. And only in the sense that Confucius is mingled with and that he complemented the devotion and mysticism of the Buddhists and the Taoist traditions could we say that Confucianism is a religion. Only in that sense. So Confucius is not a religion. And what Confucius proclaims is not a religion, but he does proclaim the way, as I've tried to put it, of moral rules. Well, let me try to briefly give you some idea of this. When he was born, things were going from bad to worse in his empire. The kings were weak. There were many intrigues, assassinations, and so on. Much corruption in the government. The nobility was leading a very wasted life. The poor and the downtrodden were suffering. In short, when he was born, kings were not acting like kings, princes like princes, ministers like ministers, fathers like fathers, brothers like brothers, friends not like friends. In other words, men were not acting human. Thus, Confucius was a sympathizer with the common people, and it opened his eyes to what maybe is his most significant truth, that true nobility is not a matter of blood, but a matter of character and culture. A man is a true man insofar as he embodies humanity. As he wrote, if a man is not human, what has he to do with rituals? If he is not human, what has he to do with music? Yet the aim of man was to cultivate his humanity. And those analects that are being passed around are simply advices about how to conduct oneself properly with other human beings. Devote yourself to man's duties, he would say. Respect spiritual beings, but keep your distance. When asked about the supernatural, he said, until you are able to serve men, how can you serve spiritual beings? Until you know about life, how can you know about death? Now, most of the analects were compiled by his students, and they bear out his concern for human nature. He speaks a good deal of ceremony. We mentioned that yesterday, li. He speaks also of humaneness, which in Chinese is ren. He speaks of reciprocity, of loyalty, of learning, and music. And all of this seems very human indeed, and have nothing to do with the divine. But one recent interpreter, this man that I mentioned to you before, Herbert Fingeret, sees, however, that there is a kind of magical quality about Confucius' reference to distinctively human powers, and we should not overlook this, he said. For example, the word li, which was mentioned yesterday, its meaning is literally holy ritual or sacred ceremony. And he asks man to act in that analect according to li. Act according to li. And submit to it. Li is the specifically humanizing form of man-to-man relationships. Now, in a well-learned ceremony, if you learn your ceremony well, each person does what he is supposed to do according to a pattern. You are not compelled by the other. The other does not compel you. You are simply coordinated. Now, if all human beings could become disciplined, turn to Li, then that would all be all that was needed. Now, this does not imply that the action would become automatic or mechanical. Then the ceremony would be dead, sterile, empty, no spirit in it. The truly ceremonial takes place. There's a kind of spontaneity to it. Therefore, you have to avoid two things in ceremony: doing things awkwardly because of lack of learning or lack of skill, and doing things mechanically, you know, with slickness, which has no commitment but only surface. Thus, Confucius will contrast the ruler who uses Li with the ruler who uses threats or commands or punishments or force. Li works through spontaneous coordination, rooted in reverent dignity. Now look what this means in the streets here of Holden. I see you, I smile, I walk toward you, I put out my hand to shake yours. And behold, without any command, stratagem, force, or tricks, you spontaneously turn toward me, you return my smile, you raise your hand toward mine. We shake hands cooperatively. I do not, unless I'm trying to be funny or to be pompous, I don't pull yours or you don't pull mine. We cooperatively shake each other's hands. Now, normally, we don't notice the subtleties of this ritual act. But to a foreigner who would visit here, you wonder, what is going on? What a strange ceremony this is. In some cultures, you shake hands with yourself, because it is felt that if you touch the hands of another, it is to soil your hands, and you may communicate diseases or something, so that this is a very unclean custom. But it is a ritual that we are used to. And to a foreigner coming here, it's a hard thing to learn how he should really do it. Therefore, the power of Li, says Confucius, is not inborn. You aren't born with knowing how to shake hands. You have to learn it. Therefore, this is something which is a fruit of education. It is the social effort of civilized society. Now, we can use Li to accomplish physical ends, too, although we don't think of it that way. For example, let us suppose I forgot to bring a book here that I wanted to read to you. If I have no magic powers, I must literally take steps to walk to my room, push open the door, lift the book physically, and carry it back. Ah, but I can also turn politely to someone and express in a polite, that is, a ritual formula, my wish to have the book, and I do not force him or threaten him, and he says, let me go get it. He goes and gets it and brings it back to me. Thus, to Confucius, Li is the way of civilized intercourse. We are treating each other as human beings and not as physical objects, as animals, or as subhuman beings to be driven. In short, there is a moral and yet a binding power of ceremony which cannot be abstracted from the ceremony. And it is in the realm of ceremony that the peculiarly human part of our life is lived. Think of the ceremonies we are involved in: promises, commitments, excuses, pleas, compliments, pacts. They are ceremonies or they are nothing. And thus, the Confucian doctrine of the rectification of names is not belief in word magic, but a concern by Confucius for man as a ceremonial being. Now, this author that I'm referring to, Fingeret, sees a moral and religious character to this, almost as if it were kind of like a holy rite. Rite is to bring out harmony and beauty in social form, but it's also a moral component to it, in that we treat other human beings as having equal dignity. They are free, cooperating participants in Li. That is, if we are open and above board in our dealings. Thus, the community of men, which is the Confucian correlate of Christian brotherhood, becomes an inextricable part of divine worship. Now, it is common to think, when you think of Confucius, that he always urged merely filial piety, you know, the devotion of sons and daughters to parents. That's the central theme. But really, it's simply the starting point of our humanity, because, like charity, it begins at home. His point is that if a man is not good at home, Neither will he be a model citizen or a trustworthy friend, or will he be a true lover of mankind. Thus, when he talks about other virtues, such as the virtue of Ren, spelled J-E-N in our transliteration, although in some transliterations put R-E-N, that's at least equal in importance to Li. It seems to, I won't get into the discussion here of all that. Many interpreters get into the, what is the difference between Ren and Li, you know, on this. But essentially, what he's trying to get out is that as humans, we are engaged in ceremonial acts with each other, and this is the specifically moral and human part of our being. And he sees this also in social life, too. Both personal and social life are actions done ceremoniously, not mechanically, not awkwardly. Acts that are li are not mere rote formula-conforming performances. They are subtle, intelligent acts. They exhibit sensitivity to context and integrity in performance. Take music as a good model. We know when there's a sensitive performance from a dull one. We detect integrity as over against somebody faking or sentimentalizing. So virtues, then, are kind of a power emanating from the person, and sort of a power of the person, which is virtue in the original sense, not virtue something as something inner. So one can see Confucius, then, as a great cultural innovator, rather than an apologist for the status quo, as he's taken by the communist Chinese today in this attack on them. He created a new ideal of society. He did not apologize for an old one. His vision was of a unified culture rooted in a unified political governance and with a hopeful unified literature, language, and ceremonial forms. And so in the Analects, he does not talk about the individual in society, but he talks about what it means to be a man, and that man is primarily what he is as derived from li, ceremony. Is it enough to be born, to eat, to breathe, to drink, and to enjoy our senses? Animals do as much. To become civilized is to establish relationships that are not merely physical, biological, or instinctive. It is to establish human relationships of an essentially symbolic kind, defined by tradition and convention and rooted in respect and obligation. Merely to feed one's parents well, says Confucius in the Analects, even the dogs and horses are fed. To be devoted to one's parents is more than to keep them alive physically. To serve and eat in the proper way. Why is that important? Why isn't it just enough just to push it in? Because it is to transform the act of mere nourishment to the human ceremony of dining. If a government governs by the whip, is not that the way dogs and horses are trained? Would it not be better to be loyal and faithful to those who rightly govern, who govern by li, and then to serve them in the human community? And that is why man's dignity lies in the ceremony, not in his biological existence. And that's why we can even sacrifice our biological existence if the right demands it. Confucius makes the point succinctly when he replied to a disciple, I'm quoting here, concerned about killing a sheep in a sacrificial rite. He says, you love the sheep, but I love the ceremony. Someone said, why should you kill the sheep? But he loved the ceremony, because this is something distinctively human. And man at his best is when he is governed by holy ceremony. Well, I'm coming to an end. Thus, he does not depict the individual as sacred. That does not mean that the individual is merely a utensil to be used by society. Society is no independent entity to be served, independent of the individuals it serves. Society is men treating other human beings as human, or according to the obligations and privileges of li, out of the love and loyalty and respect called for in their human relationship. And the rights learned and voluntarily participated in by men are self-justifying. They are the shapes of human relationships. Don't get the idea, Confucius would say, that men are subordinate to rights, nor is right subordinate to them. It is rather to have achieved a freedom in right when man is no longer a slave to his animal needs and passions. Just like our right of handshaking is not to be a slave to some kind of right, it is to be something distinctively human. Now, what does all this remind us in our own tradition? At least, as I said before in the beginning, it does remind us of the indispensable moral foundation of religion. It is not what religion is in essence, which is relationship to God. But without this moral side of it, it's dubious that most men would even take religion seriously or understand when religion is preached to them. But to me, it reminds me of the Jewish tradition, with its emphasis on the community. In contrast to the humanism of the Confucian tradition, the Jewish tradition is definitely theocentric. But God is not a God of a cult, but rather of a community that has put itself under judgment, and not one merely put under covenant. If the Hebrew nation were but an act of God, it would be no more interesting, let's say, than an earthquake or a hurricane. But the Hebrew covenant was not one-sided. That is, the individual Hebrew considered himself accessory to the covenant. But the principles of the covenant were God and the community. The individual was born into community, he died in it. It overarched his generations and bound them in the history of one people. The laws, and I better close here, I guess the bell ring, the laws of that community, you see, are the ceremony similar to the ceremony of the Confucian community. Let the children be scattered, the nation is preserved, for the nation is wherever its law is. Let the nation desert its covenant, only then is the nation dissolved. And this carried the notion with it of a nation under judgment, but a nation also under law. But a law which does not coerce them, does not come on them as some kind of heavy hand upon them, but one to which they too agree, and which they thereby become human. Through it. If the Hebrew is complete only in community, he must share the burden of responsibility for every respect in which the community is incomplete.